of a quorum. For the purposes of our traditional informational meeting, we are again fortunate to have Ken Rutledge with us, along with Jim Walthrin. Enter and sign in, please, guys. A little bit later, we'll get to Karen Whitaker from OHSU.
I wanted to start by... I was asked to bring a number of things yesterday. I brought you all the paperwork. I talked with our legal counsel. They were afraid if I brought a pizza and you ate it, that I might want to file the Ethics Commission. And so I chose to follow legal advice on that.
That's okay. We're going to unfund the Ethics Commission.
Excuse me, Ken. They don't have any money. So, you know, that's not cutting any ice with us, buddy.
All right. Well, it was the best excuse I could think of.
Yeah. You're standing on the fifth.
There's one correction that I need to make from yesterday, and I'll explain it. In the packet I gave you on the top sheet, I have redone one of the pages, and I'll tell you what happened. When I did the analysis for the fourth quarter of 2002 and 2001, the Kaiser system for their hospital in Sunnyside, they submit expense data, but they don't submit revenue data. And I can't totally understand it, but it has something to do with they don't count it as revenue because it comes through their health plan. And what we always have to do is we have to plug in revenue numbers for them, or we have to pull them out of the analysis. And that was done on the 2001 data, but not the 2002. And so one of the reasons the numbers were so dramatic for the last quarter was there was no data for revenue for Kaiser. So I've corrected those. The trend's the same, not quite as dramatic. What it now shows for that fourth quarter is that patient service margin statewide fell from 0.6% to -1.2 as opposed to -2.4. Operating margins fell from 4.6 to 2.8 as opposed to 1.5. And total margins fell from 5.9 to 1.6, which I think is as opposed to 0.3, I believe, is what I had in it yesterday. So
yes.
Same direction, but I wanted to, when I caught that, I thought, well, I better make the correction. And the second sheet is actually the printout that I did that, you know, shows those numbers. I provided two charts from our Lewin study that deal with Medicaid payments in Oregon. The first one is a chart that they did using American Hospital Association annual survey data, which shows under this one, it shows Oregon at 82%. For the period that they covered, but this is compared with the rest of the states. I will say that this information, although we submit data in Oregon 100%, it's not the same case in a lot of other states, and so you have to take this with a little bit of flexibility here. The next one, however, which I think...
What's that 82% mean, Ken? 82% of average, 82%
of the cost.
Okay.
82% of the cost. Although, as you saw yesterday, the Lewin study showed that the actual number for Oregon is 72% when they looked at detailed data.
Does this include the long-term care figure?
No.
This is great.
This would be acute care only.
Okay.
And the next sheet basically shows Medicaid spending per enrollee for all of the states. And you can see Oregon down there in 39th place out of 51 in terms of spending per enrollee.
And again, this is acute care.
That's correct. No, that's total Medicaid spending. This is total Medicaid spending for all forms of Medicaid.
So that would include long-term care.
Yes.
Representative Cruz.
So when you say all forms of Medicare, that would include
Medicaid,
that would include the Medicaid dollars going through Department of Ed, everything, or
these, you know, I didn't, you know, it was the Lewin people who did the study. They used basically Healthcare Financing Administration forms that show total dollars and total numbers of beneficiaries, and I'd almost have to have them come in to get into the nuances of.
There are just so many different streams of Medicaid funding that it's. Yeah. It's
well, you know, one of the, and here's one of the difficulties. You know, yesterday I inadvertently brought you the Medicare chart, and one of the reasons that they have the Medicare charts in there is that you're comparing apples with apples. It's basically, you know, you've got people who are over 65 or on SSI or on renal dialysis, and so there's a little more uniformity for doing comparisons with Medicaid because you have different populations covered, and each one of those populations has a little bit different average cost. It's tougher to do the comparisons. I think a good comparison is one, however, that does look at the percentage of cost paid to the providers. But once again, there's not a good database for that other than this AHA annual survey, and that doesn't collect data from all hospital providers around the country.
Okay, Mr. Chair, but this is basically off of data collected from hospitals or?
From hospitals. The American Hospital Association, for as long as I've been affiliated with them, which is probably 25 years, they have done an annual survey of hospitals. This is now it's done on the internet, and it's the only really national database that includes hospitals in all 50 states, and so most of the comparisons that you see between states, a lot of those are based on information collected by the American Hospital Association. The weakness is that the participation in that survey varies from state to state, from 100% here in Oregon to other states where it might only be 30-40% of the hospitals that report.
Okay, Mr. Chair, my reason, when you look at Medicaid enrollees, that's certainly a higher number than we have in the Oregon Health Plan, so it's obviously including some other categories, I mean, medically needy, some other things, and there's some Medicaid dollars go through the Department of Ed's for special needs kids and different things like that, so it may be that comprehensive.
The other things that I brought you, there was a request by Representative March. He wanted to see if we could look at both ER visits, charity care, and bad debt trends from before the Oregon Health Plan through today. And as I think I explained to you, initially the Oregon Health Plan really did achieve some of the things it was intended to in terms of reducing emergency room use, reducing charity and bad debts. And then as you can see, around 1998, particularly with respect to ER visits and charity care, those numbers started going up. And charity care stayed down for a longer period of time, and as you can see, just the last year, it's pretty much exploded so that it's now above the level that it was way back in 93 when we went to the Oregon Health Plan. The other thing I think, Representative Cruz, you asked for, I have two lists here. The first one shows the hospitals that have long-term care beds or nursing homes.
Okay.
The other, it was easier for me to list the hospitals that don't have home health care agencies than to list the ones that do.
Okay.
So
okay.
These are the ones that don't. All the rest of the hospitals in the state have home health care agencies, so that's the majority of them.
That's very good. Thank you.
And that's all I had to submit, unless there were any further questions. I just wanted to follow up with that run correction and then give you the materials that were requested yesterday.
So there'd be 42 hospitals then that have some. Oh, this is the ones that do have long-term.
No, do not.
Do have long-term care, don't have home health care.
Yes. Oh, I'm looking on the wrong.
Okay, and most of those are A and Bs, too, aren't they?
Yeah. In fact, I think almost all of the, very few of the smaller hospitals don't have a home health care agency because typically they're in communities where if you don't have it attached to the hospital, it can't make it on its own as freestanding.
Right. Usually, if they're not attached to the hospital, like, for instance, in Curry County, it's the county that runs the home health operation.
Okay.
As opposed to the hospital.
We can get some more on that sort of thing from Karen later on, I think. So.
Any other questions for Ken? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you for this information, the ER visits. I'm looking at it. And it really, I mean, if you look at 99 was basically the same as 93. So we, you know, it really did make a difference, even though it started to creep back up by then, and our population was growing at the same time. So, you know, I think it proved its value.
It really did early on accomplish what it was supposed to, and I think I spent probably 4 years going around the country making presentations to different groups talking what a success the Oregon Health Plan had been. And when it was well funded and we had the resources and we had the managed care structure in place, it really did do what it was intended to do in getting people out of emergency rooms and undoing a lot of the charity care.
So it wasn't until like 2000 when then you could see the real jump starts taking place, and we had we you know been using this information, we maybe would have planned better in the last session.
Well, don't forget the
we don't want to go there.
In all of
right,
this.
Right.
We don't want to go there.
Anything else for Mr. Rutledge?
Well, maybe, and Mr. Chair, I'm not sure Ken can really answer this. I mean, we know why initially managed care worked as well as it did. Why did the bottom fall out?
You know, it's somewhat of a tough question, but I think it's this. Initially, the capitation rates were probably adequate to cover the actual cost of providing care to this population. But one of the things you have to do is, as you go along, you have to learn and you have to make adjustments. And in effect, what happened was the commercial plans discovered over time that they were beginning to lose significant amounts of dollars covering this population. And the fear that they had was that it was definitely going to have an impact on their ability to serve their commercial patients. And they really couldn't it was one of these things where since some of the health plans didn't participate, those who did felt themselves increasingly at a competitive disadvantage in terms of what their pricing was going to be to the private sector. And so for competitive reasons, they were forced to pull out. It's not unlike what we've seen with physicians and others who have the option of either minimizing or eliminating services to groups where their costs aren't covered. But I think that's it. You know, the ones who stayed around, most of them are dedicated, for the most part, dedicated to providing managed care to the OHP population, and so they don't have that whole issue of cross subsidization because that is their business.
We heard very interesting testimony earlier in the week from Douglas County
IPA County,
where they actually managed care and talked about it as managed care. I mean, is it safe to say that most of the people who got involved in so-called managed care were managing dollars, but they weren't really managing care?
Well, you know, that raises a good point. Early on, even with the commercial health plans, Blue Cross, Providence, and the others who participated, the hospitals and the physicians and the health plans sort of jointly went at risk. I mean, they shared in the upside and the downside risk, and then what began to happen was that the hospitals and the physicians learned that the risk was all downside, and so they would no longer be willing to, in effect, have a withhold, which they would lose if the utilization was too high. That forced all the risk onto the health plans. That's why they pulled out. In the case of Douglas County, or if you're down in the Corvallis area, or over in central Oregon or other areas where we have these kinds of health plans, it's a physician, hospital, health plan still sharing the risk, and so they all have the same incentives to try and control utilization and to control costs. once the physicians and the hospitals were unwilling to take part of that risk with the commercial health plans, there was, you know, the incentives were not there, and the health plan really didn't have anyone to share the risk with, and so they saw nothing but the downside of it.
Any other questions for Mr. Rutledge? Okay. Ken, we eat about 4 o'clock, so you've got plenty of time to get down to Shakey's and get that pizza, buddy, while Jim is testifying.
I need to. He's one of my officers on the association. I do need to sit here with him and correct him if he makes any mistakes.
Yeah.
And, Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, but my experience with Jim is he's perfectly capable of covering his own behind.
You know, that was my sense of the whole thing. I mean, I think
it's a dodge to avoid pizza myself.
Unbelievable. Jim, enter and sign in.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Wathen.
Could you pull that mic close to you? Okay. I mean, get real friendly with it, because otherwise folks in the back can't hear.
My name is Jim Wathen. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for the Southern Coos Health District, which is located in Bandon and serves most of Southern Coos County and a small part of Northern Curry County. I'm also an officer and a member of the Board of Directors for both the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems and the Oregon Rural Health Association. Please keep in mind that the issues and descriptions that I'm conveying this afternoon are fairly synonymous with those of 30 other Type A and Type B hospitals in this state, and that 12 of us also have nursing homes as a part of our operation. The Southern Coos Health District has been in continuous operation since 1960, serving Southern Coos County. We presently operate a 21-bed critical access hospital, a Type B hospital, a 37-bed intermediate care nursing facility, and a home health agency. We employ over 150 healthcare associates with a payroll of $5 million per year, and that's a significant contributor to our local economy. We're a significant presence in our community. Our associates comprise 2% of our total district population. We're not just employers and caregivers. We contribute to the lifeblood of our communities. We're friends, neighbors, community leaders, club members, supporters of local businesses, schools, and churches, and participants in every imaginable community activity. Our presence as a provider and contributor is similar to that of all other rural hospitals in this state, which fulfill similar roles in their respective communities. Collectively, it's our mission to keep rural Oregon healthy. My interest in keeping rural Oregon healthy is what brings me here today. The continuing ability of small hospitals in rural Oregon to fulfill their roles and meet the needs of their constituents remains very fragile. The typical rural hospital experiences a service utilization mix which is high in both Medicare and Medicaid utilization. Right now, both of these programs actually pay us based upon what they determine to be reasonable cost, not actual cost of providing care. Because of this, our charges for services are set at a level which requires commercial insurance companies to pay more for the care that their premium payers receive in order to make up for what government programs don't pay us for their beneficiaries. In essence, this means that all of our local employers who provide health care coverage for their employees are paying a hidden tax or premium through their health insurance programs so that our hospitals can approach break even on our operations. If we did not set our charges for services in this manner, we would eventually deplete our assets and have to go out of business. It's called asset consumption, and if you are operating a business that way, eventually you don't have any assets to operate off of, and you go out of business.
Jeff calls it
eating his seed corn.
Taking our hospital as an example, Southern Coos Hospital is the third smallest hospital in the state of Oregon in terms of gross revenues. 65% of our revenues come from Medicare. 8% comes from Oregon Health Plan, Oregon Medical Assistance Programs. And the remaining 27% is a combination of commercially insured and privately paying individuals. Of this group, 10% end up being bad debt and charity care. Our operating margins have been fragile for most of the past 30 years. In 2001, our operating margin was minus 13%. In 2002, our operating margin was minus 4.2%. This year to date, our operating margin stands at minus 6.7%. If we presume that cost protections will no longer be available to A and B hospitals, our year-to-date margin will drop to minus 9% at a minimum when taking into account a switch to DRG payments and further DRG payment reductions. And that loss deepens if retroactive or presumptive eligibility goes away. The fact of the matter is that as a whole, A and B hospitals in this state do not have healthy bottom lines. Most of us do not have positive operating margins. Some of us are fortunate to have positive total margins. And without cost-based reimbursement, none of us have enough commercially insured business to overcome the losses we will incur without that cost-based reimbursement or the ability to retroactively bill for otherwise eligible Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries. The cost implications of legislative and state agency decisions does not stop with our hospitals, at least not in our community. We and 12 other rural A and B hospitals own and operate nursing facilities. These operations are facing severe and damaging cuts to what the state currently pays for the cost of providing care to state-funded residents. In our facility, Ocean View Care Center, 40% of our residents are state-funded. Based upon the current proposed cuts in payments, there is an exceptionally high potential that we will close that facility. This means that 25 nursing home residents will be displaced and 45 of our health care associates currently employed by the district will be laid off. That's almost one-third of our workforce. This will not only have a significant impact upon our local economy and the community, it will further place demands upon the limited resources of this state in terms of unemployment and further use of the Oregon Health Plan.
Jim, hold on half a second.
Yes, sir.
25 nursing home patients displaced and 45 employees?
Correct.
So is there, am I to infer from that that there is a more than one-to-one patient-employee ratio there?
In terms of all full and part-time employees, that's correct, because we provide services 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
So what is that in terms of full-time equivalents?
Full-time equivalents, it's probably more in the line of 34 to 35 full-time equivalents.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
You have more than one employee per patient.
That's correct.
Okay.
We also have five physicians practicing in our community. They are all fundamentally dedicated to the care of all of our district residents. Unfortunately, their reimbursement for the care that they provide is even worse than for institutional providers. Two of our physicians no longer accept assignments for Medicare patients. None of our physicians in the local community are currently accepting Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries into their practices. This has severely curtailed access to care for almost 20% of the residents of our health district. In summary, I'd have to say all is not doom and gloom. We're there for the course, and we try our best. we keep our costs paired as closely as we can and still try to provide a high quality of service in our hospital, a high quality of life in our nursing home. And the same thing is happening with other rural facilities throughout the state. We've built a new hospital, which has now been in operation for over 3 years. Our utilization levels as a result of that have increased more than 300% compared to 5 years ago. Our community looks to us for fulfillment of their health service needs. This same scenario is playing out in every rural community in this state, which is being served by AMD hospitals. This has been in large part made possible through adequate reimbursement mechanisms, retroactive eligibility, and the community confidence which begins to play out when local hospitals can demonstrate sustained performance, which becomes the primary contributor to the general health of the communities that we serve. That concludes my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions for Jim?
I'd point out that Curry County, the base of the economy in Curry County is timber and fishing, and very little else except there's a few people raising cows, but not a whole lot. And they're probably one of the more depressed parts of the state economically at this point in time, if not the most depressed. So, talk about critical need, and I guess I'm wondering, you said that none of the docs are taking health plan clients now. Are they not taking any, or they're not taking any new ones?
We have two physicians who are serving health plan clients and are not taking any new clients. The remaining three physicians in our community no longer accept Oregon Health Plan patients, period.
So you get all of those yourself, don't you?
I think we see when they feel they have nowhere else to go, I think their first choice is probably the emergency room of their local hospital.
And is that a reimbursement rate issue with those three physicians? They just can't make it work in terms of the payer mix?
I think for two out of the three, that would be a correct assumption. For the third physician, he has no interest in serving that population whatsoever.
Maybe this is an unfair question. Is that third physician, in your guesstimate, would he be the physician that has the highest gross income of the three?
That would also be a correct assumption.
Rick, and then Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Chair. Jim, I have an interest in the aging population along the coast, I guess, based on the effect of the retirement draw. And, have you seen a change in the number of seniors in your community? And can you talk a little bit about what kind of impact this is having, maybe along the coast in your area, maybe compared to other parts of Oregon, if you can talk in those kind of terms?
I think I don't know that I can speak for other hospitals in the area. I think it's generally a truism for rural communities, but in particularly for the South Coast, that we experienced a very high percentage of our population being age 64 and older. In Bandon, that percentage is between 27% and 28% age 64 and older. That's more than twice the national average, and it's almost twice the state average. That means that a significant, and as I said, 65% of our revenue comes from Medicare. And since we are a critical access hospital, that means they, like currently under the Oregon Health Plan, are reimbursing what they determine to be reasonable costs. So you get most of your costs covered for that percentage of the population determined by your ratio of cost to charges for your own operation. When all you're doing is covering costs, that means you have nothing to put back into the replacement of plant and equipment, and eventually over the years, you deplete your assets. And when you've depleted your assets and you continue to run at minus operating margins, when you have to replace for the benefit of your community and in order to provide a standard of service in terms of hospital care, you can't do it because your financials won't allow anybody to lend you the money to do it. So you end up closing your doors.
Representative Greenwald. Can I ask a slightly peripheral question? How's the emergency care system in your health district? Does some of these financial issues affect the ability to provide emergency care services?
If we want to operate a hospital, we have to have an emergency room and operate it. So we really don't have a choice there. The emergency system within Coos County, I think, works fairly well. We have good emergency transportation systems within the county. Some of them are city-owned. Some of them are privately operating ambulance systems. But they have served us well. Emergency rooms are the most expensive place to obtain your care. And that is where hospitals typically will experience their greatest losses, is also in the emergency room, because those who are not insured or who are underinsured will tend to utilize that as their stopping point of choice, especially in communities, and this is increasingly the case, I think, throughout much of the state, where if you want to get in to see your doctor, you may be 3 weeks to 2 months out before you can get an appointment. So if there's something that they're deeply concerned about, then even though it may call for a physician's office visit, they're going to come to the emergency room for care.
Okay. Your point that you have to have an emergency room means that the emergency room is going to be open 24 hours. For sort of, I mean, depending on what's going on. I was wondering whether the fact that people are showing up in the emergency room while you have an emergency room open helps to cut the losses rather than increase the losses.
I don't believe so. Our experience, and I think Ken's numbers that he provided you today are reflective of this. In emergency medicine, the people who have real emergencies come in. Percentage are always going to be uninsured or underinsured. And as people feel less and less in control, the more time it takes them to get in for an appointment with their physician, the more often abdominal pain or an earache or something like that is going to show up in the emergency room, because that's how they're going to get treatment. That's how they're going to get the prescriptions to take care of the illness that they have, because they can't wait that 3 weeks to 2 months to get in to see their local physician. In some communities, this is simply also reflective of the shortages that we have of qualified professionals in the healthcare field right now. And it isn't just with physicians. It's also with nurses in our hospitals and radiologic technologists in our hospitals and pharmacists and medical technologists in our laboratories. I don't like to say it, but I've been in healthcare for 78 years. I'm 78 years. I hold my age very well. since 1978.
Going to go down to your hospital for treatment.
This is probably as tumultuous as I have seen the industry, and not just in terms of the shortage of healthcare professionals, but in terms of the financial nightmares that we tend to deal with on a daily basis, and with the number of people who the increasing number of people who are uninsured or underinsured, we simply haven't seen something like this since probably the 50s and prior to that, when health insurance and commercial insurances really hadn't kicked in that much.
If I may, just ask one thing. I mean, here's where I'm trying to go. You said you have to have an emergency. I'm kind of interested in the emergency care system. Okay. And you're going to have nurses there and medical technologists and maybe a doctor around mm-hmm. the call. Let's say nobody showed up in that room except a true emergency. You would have revenue collected from those people who show up with true emergencies. Mm-hmm. Now you have other people showing up. And those people, some bring revenue and some don't bring revenue. But I was trying to get whether you ever thought of how this additional revenue comes to the emergency room to help maintain it for only the emergency mm-hmm. service. That, I think that's what
I think it's a for me it's a tough question to answer because I don't have a methodology or avenue to approach that in terms of true operations right now. I'm required to have an emergency room, and whoever shows up at the door, I must provide service to, at least in terms of a medical screening examination, even if they don't have a true emergency. It would be nice if there were a methodology for controlling who comes into that emergency room so we knew that the care was always appropriate, no matter who showed up at the door. But we live in a system where it's still illegal to shoot people who come there inappropriately, and that would be the first signal to everybody who doesn't have an emergency to stay away. So I don't know that there's a good answer for that, and I conceptually I don't have an answer for it.
Mitch, I think I know where you're headed,
and it is a tough one. I would think in maybe some of the larger facilities with tertiary services, to the degree that the emergency room is a feeder to those services, and you've got a mix of people with insurance into those more profitable areas, then that's probably the case. Obviously, if you've got an emergency room and you've got it fully staffed and you've got a doctor on call, and you get two people in, and you get X number of dollars from them, well, if you get six in, you know, and it's not putting a burden on you, then maybe there is a little bit more revenue. But it's. You know, the math probably isn't enough to say we want people to not go to the doctor but to come to the emergency room.
I'm worried about the emergency system. That's one of the things that's really worrying me around the state, both in terms of the trauma center designation and other things. And I was just wondering the extent to which we're feeding something, we're exacerbating the emergency room situation by the fact that people are showing up without money. I mean, whether it's especially hitting the emergency room, that was all I was built for, or whether it's a club. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any additional questions for Mr. Walton? Let the record show that Jim comported himself in a very professional and erudite manner. Ergo, that dang Rutledge could have gone out and got us a pizza.
I could understand why Ken wanted to stay, because he did get confused towards the end on how old he was, and that's the fundamental mistake.
But he deported himself pretty well, but he slipped right there.
Yeah, he
did. So they call that early onset.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'd like to call Karen Whitaker, Vice Provost. OHSU, Office of Rural Health. Karen, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me to talk about rural health care. The paper that you're being handed out is something I've called a snapshot of health care, of rural health in Oregon. I think poor Representative Cruz has seen this now two times before. He's sat through it many times. He probably knows the data better than I do. But what this is intended is just to give you a context in which to consider the information that you've been hearing about about hospitals, and particularly about rural hospitals. And I don't think I'm going to spend a lot of time going through every bit of it. The first part of it talks about the various definitions of rural. There are people, of course, who spend their whole lives studying what rural is and write books about it, and it really isn't that important in Oregon. We know what works and what rural is, and it's most of the state, as a matter of fact. It's about 91% of the land mass of the state and about 40% of the population. And the way we define rural in our office is a geographic area 10 or more miles from a population center of 30,000 or more. And then we talk about frontier areas, remote rural and less remote, kind of look at some degrees of rurality. But most of the data in this report and the graphs that I'm going to show you are organized into four different types. And these are counties, four types of counties. We have 10 counties in Oregon that are frontier rural. They have six or fewer people per square mile. They're all in eastern Oregon or central or eastern Oregon. And some of them, in fact, have less than one person per square mile, like Harney County. And then there are those whose entire geographic area is either remote or less remote rural. And those are all of the coastal counties, of course, Coos County, Curry County, all of the ones up and down the coast. And there is a map in here on the third page that, I'm sorry, doesn't have real good definition. We're trying not to print in color these days, so we want to show you we don't have very good contrast here. And then there are some counties that are a mixture of urban and rural, and then there are those whose geographic area are entirely urban, and in fact there's only one of those counties, and that's Multnomah County. So the data that I'm going to show you is organized in that way. And if you want to look at the distribution of population, that's on the second page. Most of our population are in mixed urban and rural counties. Almost 20% are in Multnomah County, only 2.5% in frontier counties, and 23% in the counties that are exclusively rural. And what I want to talk with you about in terms of context are rural demographics, the health status of people in rural areas, and then we'll talk a bit about rural health care facilities and workforce. And as Jim mentioned, the population in rural communities is disproportionately elderly. And the graph at the top of page 4 shows you for those four classes of counties that the frontier counties have about 14% over 65. The urban county has about 11% over 65, and the statewide average is 12.3%. Now, in some counties, like Coos County and Curry County, we've got upwards of 25 to 27% people over 65. That, of course, makes quite a difference in the demands on the healthcare system, and also makes a difference in terms of the type of reimbursement that people receive for hospital care and for physician care. Rural Oregonians as a group also have lower per capita incomes than their urban counterparts. And we have an exact inverse relationship here in figure 4, where the frontier counties have a per capita income of $17,829, and Multnomah County's per capita income is $30,672, almost twice as much as the frontier counties. And there's just a direct relationship. Data from the Employment Department further show that frontier and rural unemployment rates remain higher. In frontier counties, the rate, and that this was the February 2003 rate, is 14.8%. The unfortunate thing is that the frontier counties of the state never did enjoy the boom that some of the other counties in the state enjoyed in the 90s, and some of them never got out of double-digit unemployment. haven't been for a couple of decades. Health status in rural Oregon is also a little bit different, and I think Representative Greenlich asked about emergency care. One of the first graphs that I want to show you, which is figure 6, looks at unintended injury death rates per 100,000 population and makes a statement most likely about emergency health care services in rural Oregon. In frontier counties, the death rate per 100,000 population is almost 57, and in urban counties, it's 34.07. We don't know exactly what the reason is for that. These are accidents, by the way, primarily motor vehicle accidents, but also occupational accidents. We're not sure why that is. It could be access to emergency medical services. It most likely is that they have to travel long ways to get emergency services, and I have some further information about that later on.
Question?
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Karen. Do you, in the frontier, the unintended injury death rates, would that be broken down by age? I was wondering if they're predominantly more elderly that are injury prone or youth. Do you have a sense?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, I don't know.
Okay.
It would be interesting to look at it. My guess on this is that it is younger people.
Okay.
Who are more likely to be involved in a dangerous occupation or more likely to be involved in a speeding car.
Okay.
But it would be interesting to look and see, and I'd be happy to do that.
Okay.
Rural populations also demonstrate a much higher rate of death associated with tobacco use. And interestingly, the numbers of people who smoke in rural Oregon tend to be slightly smaller than those who smoke in urban Oregon. But those who do smoke use more products. They smoke more cigarettes. They use more chewing tobacco than their counterparts in urban areas. So this is quite a striking difference in Figure 7. More than 25% of the deaths in frontier counties are tobacco-related, and just about 21% in the urban county, which is Multnomah County. You've heard already about workforce issues, and that certainly is an issue that affects rural hospitals as well, but there is a shortage of qualified healthcare personnel throughout rural Oregon. There are problems recruiting nurses, dentists, dental hygienists, and all allied healthcare workers, but the chart that I have on page 7 looks at the ratio of physicians to population by county type and illustrates that in frontier counties, the ratio is about 1,300 people per physician. And in Multnomah County, if you're sitting in a room with 200 people, one of them is probably going to be a physician. So there are a lot of physicians in Multnomah County who, in all fairness, serve more than just the people in Multnomah County because Portland, of course, is a referral center. The Shep Research Center at the University of North Carolina conducted a study of rural physicians and concluded what we all intuitively already knew, and that is that they work longer hours, they earn less money, they have a higher percentage of their revenue from Medicare and Medicaid than their urban counterparts, and they're more productive than their urban counterparts. It's difficult to recruit physicians to rural communities when you say to them, you're going to work harder, you're going to earn less money, schools are not going to be as good, your spouse probably can't find a job, and they have $200,000 in debt to pay back from medical school and their residency training. So it's getting tougher and tougher to recruit physicians to rural Oregon.
Could you clarify what you mean by more productive, i.e. see more patients per doctor, is that
yeah,
for the ratio?
Vice Chair, yes. They are likely to work longer hours, see more patients in those hours, and because there are fewer of them, so they just have to do that. The health profession shortage area, what we call... Oh,
I'm sorry. Just come out of
question,
thank you, Chair. Pop that question, and some of this plays into some visits that some previous committees made out to the rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
You see... a greater number of doctors and other health professionals that tend to cycle out to frontier or rural areas and back into the city. You tend to lose people who want to go back to the city closer to like educational or social life, or is it different than how they lose people or not? Mm-hmm. The workforce shortage issues in the urban areas.
Interestingly enough, we did a study about 5 years ago of our tax credit recipients, our physician tax credit recipients, and looked at the ones who had left the state, and we were getting about a 19% turnover rate, which is high. And when we looked to see where they had gone, because they left us their forwarding addresses because they wanted to be sure and get their certificate to get their tax credit when they filed their taxes the following year, most of them did not go back to an urban setting. Most of them actually went to a more rural setting in another state. They went to Alaska or Wyoming or Montana, and our assumption from that was that they were attempting to escape managed care. Now, of course, there isn't as much managed care in rural Oregon as there was 5 years ago, but that was just anecdotally some of the information that we were getting from them. So that was 5 years ago. Things may have changed, but my impression is that they don't go to urban, and they don't go anywhere in Oregon. They go out of the state, and they go more rural. The HPSA Health Profession Shortage Area designation and the MUA-MUP Medically Underserved Area, Medically Underserved People or Populations designations, those are federal designations, and they identify areas of the country with severe health provider access issues. In Oregon, 32 of our 36 counties have this HPSA designation, and 33 of our 36 counties have either medically underserved areas or medically underserved populations. And some of those are in Multnomah County, by the way. We certainly have medically underserved populations in Multnomah County. In 1987, Oregon's legislature made a finding regarding rural hospitals. And it said that the Legislative Assembly finds that Oregon's rural hospitals are an integral part of the communities and geographic area where they are located. Their impact on the economic well-being and health status of the citizens is vast. The problems faced by rural hospitals include a general decline in rural economies, the age of the rural populations, older physical plants, lack of physicians and other health care providers, and a poor financial outlook. The Legislative Assembly recognizes that the loss of essential hospital services is imminent in many communities. And in fact, in the 1980s, Oregon's rural hospitals closed at the rate of about one a year for a decade. And that was primarily due to the hardship of prospective Medicare payment, what you hear talked about as DRG reimbursement. And in 1987, Oregon's legislature provided the Type A rural hospitals with cost-based Medicaid reimbursement to help offset some of those Medicare losses. And in 1989, they added the Type B rural hospitals to that list as well. And that is something that we are the only state that has provided that. There are a few now who provide it to critical access hospitals like Jim's Hospital, but we are the only state that has been consistent in providing cost-based Medicaid reimbursement. For the first time in more than a decade, of course, Oregon's budget deficits may lead to eliminating the cost-based Medicaid reimbursement program that has successfully maintained access to hospital care for rural Oregons in 32 of Oregon's 36 counties. Oregon's rural hospitals stand to lose better than $24 million in the upcoming biennium as a result, and some of them will almost certainly close.
Mr. Wood-Coban.
Thank you, Chair. Karen, I've heard this several times. I keep kind of forgetting the description of critical access hospital. If you briefly just review what that
is, sure,
how
Rick,
that's differentiated from regular.
This is a federal-state partnership program, the Critical Access Hospital Program. And it means that a hospital has the option, at least, to scale down. It does have to scale down to no more than 15 acute care beds. It can have up to 25 beds if 10 of them are what they call swing beds that you swing into long-term care. They get cost-based Medicare reimbursement in return for that. And their requirements are very minimal, although none of Oregon's critical access hospitals has gone down to this minimal level of service. All they really have to do is maintain an emergency room, and they don't even have to staff it if there's nobody in the hospital at the time. They can, it could technically be a phone on the outside door, and somebody could come and say, hey, we've got a problem, we need, with as long as they're there within half an hour, then that's legal. We don't have anything like that in Oregon, but some states do, and states like in the Midwest primarily. But in Oregon, our rural hospitals have seized upon this program as an opportunity really to provide additional services. And so their services have become more rich, in fact, than they were before they became a critical access hospital. It has really stabilized some of the rural hospitals. It's been a very successful program. We have 15 now.
That was my question.
Mm-hmm. Most of Oregon's 31 rural hospitals were built during the 1950s and 1960s using federal Hill-Burton funds, with the exception of Jim's beautiful hospital that was just built a few years ago. You ought to drive down to Bandon and see his nice hospital. Their physical plants are designed for inpatient services, and they have not been able to adapt successfully to the transition to predominant outpatient services. Access to capital to adapt to 21st century patient demands is very challenging. Oregon's 2001 Legislative Assembly appropriated $15 million for rural facilities through the Rural Health Viability Grant Program, but as all of you know, throughout five special budget balancing sessions, the funds were cut to 3.75, and they have never been released.
Well aware of that, have commented on it on many occasions, and wondering when the governor is going to release our money. And now, miraculously, on the potential cut list, there it is again.
Well, and the fact that it's MUPL money may have something to be concerned about as well.
Yes.
Oregon's frontier hospitals are characterized by sparsely populated counties. They have the lowest occupancy rate of all Oregon hospitals, less than 20% on an average annual basis. And figure 9 shows the difference between the frontier hospital and the average urban hospital has almost 60% occupancy rate. That goes up to about 85% for the hospital, University Hospital at OHSU. And there's actually one rural hospital, the hospital in Heppner, has an average daily census of less than one. So it's a very tiny hospital, only has 12 beds. The high percentage of elderly and low-income patients places an additional burden on rural hospitals, and figure 10 shows you the combined percent of Medicare and Medicaid discharges in Oregon hospitals by county type, around 60% for frontier and rural combined Medicare and Medicaid, down to 34% for hospitals in Multnomah County. Oregon's 7 frontier hospitals, and there are 10 frontier counties, 3 of those counties have no hospital, operated at a combined deficit of minus $5,259,000 during the last audited year, 2001, an average loss of $751,000 per hospital. Some of those hospitals are in health districts where they have some tax money available to them. The average is about $200,000 to $250,000, so most of them continue to operate at an overall deficit bottom line. Studies conducted by Dr. Gerald Dirksen at Oklahoma State University have concluded that each job in a rural hospital creates 2.25 jobs in the local economy, and that the operating revenues of a rural hospital are returned to the community by a factor of 1.5. Using those data, Oregon's rural hospitals generate 24,258 jobs and return nearly $3 billion to their local economy. So Oregon's rural hospitals are powerful economic engines for their communities and are often the leading employer in a community. I wanted to conclude by chatting a bit about emergency medical services, because that is a field that our office has been active in the last two biennia. In 1999, the legislature passed Senate Bill 911, which used less than 1% of the money from the criminal fines and assessment account for the Office of Rural Health and the Area Health Education Centers at OHSU to distribute to rural communities for rural EMS equipment and for educational purposes as well. We conducted a survey of all of the EMS agencies that we deal with in that grant program in 2001, and they about 600 of them responded, reported that 77.8% of their staff is volunteer, who typically respond to a call from home or from work. Many of these agencies, 45% of the respondents, are what they call quick response units. That means they don't transport a patient to a hospital. They go to the scene, they stabilize the patient, and they wait to meet the ambulance. And those are almost entirely 100% volunteers. Most of them have no budget at all. They just have gotten together and trying to be good folks and do good work. When survey respondents were asked to list their primary challenges, they talked about finances, equipment needs, recruitment and retention, and training. Overall, with the funds from Senate Bill 911, the Office of Rural Health has received 294 applications from 137 rural communities, asking for $5,195,146. And we have been able to fund about 20% of those requests, or a little over $1 million. We have purchased 7 ambulances, 3 quick response vehicles, 60 defibrillators, 7 ventilators, 101 radios, 76 pagers, 11 Jaws of Life rescue tools, and we have provided repairs, maintenance, and insurance for numerous rescue vehicles, plus a lot of other various equipment like pulse oximeters, stretchers, gurneys, resuscitators, and so on. One rural community asked us for $500 to buy pads for their defibrillator because they didn't have any pads. They had an old defibrillator. They weren't asking for a new one. They just wanted $500 for pads. So we just wrote them a check and sent it to them right away. We figured that was a critical issue. The reason I'm belaboring this, I'm sure you can figure out, is that these funds are also slated for elimination in the 2003-2005 budget. So in summary, rural healthcare in rural Oregon is compromised by challenging demographics, by health disparities. They suffer from a shortage of qualified healthcare providers. The hospitals are financially fragile and physically inadequate, and there are very few resources available to assist them. Emergency medical services in rural Oregon are primarily delivered by volunteers who rely on state EMS enhancement funds for both equipment needs and education. Oregon has a national reputation for its unique rural health care programs. And like many of Oregon's popular and successful state-sponsored services, our rural benefits are also being reexamined by a legislature that faces many difficult choices in the months ahead. So I am in sympathy with those choices, but I thank you for the work that you've done in rural health in the past and hope that you can continue to do so in the future.
I'd just point out, for those who weren't here in 99, the funding for Senate Bill 911 through the unitary assessment was only possible because the Senate co-chair of Ways and Means was the sponsor of the bill. And that was also a session where there seemed to be somewhat of a feeding frenzy on unitary assessment. So I think there's a sense of taking that back to the original intent of the unitary assessment rather than a funding trough for many other things. But I have been to some of these very remote EMS places like Granite, and which is all volunteer, and it's a million miles from anywhere. And, you know, these folks are just trying to get the bare necessities to keep people alive, and it's kind of a critical thing. And I'd also, how far away from, I mean, you say Heppner Hospital has less than one patient per day, but how far away is it from the nearest hospital?
Representative Cruz, I think Heppner is probably about 60 miles from the Dalles. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, distance is a huge factor in a lot of these Not these rural hospitals.
And if you've ever driven down there on a foggy night, that's foggy all the time there in the wintertime with a little two-lane highway, it's, you know, without a hospital in Heppner, it'd be a scary place to live.
Yeah, I mean, it's longer than 60 miles, based on 60 miles on I-5, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Just a little editorial pitch there for rural health care.
Mr. Berkovian.
Thank you, Chair. Karen, can you talk a little bit about, you know, we've heard a lot about medical liability and its impact on the system. Is it hitting rural Oregon, and is it any different than what we're seeing, maybe the impact in the urban areas?
Rick, I think like any other issue, there are less resources available in rural Oregon. Physicians make less money. They're less able to afford the liability insurance premium that they need to pay. And most of the family physicians in rural Oregon are participating in obstetrical care because there are no obstetricians. So they don't make a lot of money, and their malpractice rates are as high as an obstetrician's. I was talking with a physician in Lakeview a few months ago. He's a family physician. He does OB, and his premiums went up to $40,000 the first of the year. Now, I doubt that he makes much more than $70,000 or $80,000. The hospital's helping him pay his premium right now, but I don't know how long they can continue to do that. So he's still providing OB care, but that's not the case in a lot of rural communities. A lot of them have had to stop.
Any other questions, committee members? Well, I had one. You mentioned that over the decade of the 90s, approximately one rural hospital a year closed. Were those in places where they were the only facility, or were they in competition in some areas?
Representative March, let me. I'm just trying to think. There's a mixture, actually. The one that probably was the least visible or needed was in Central Point. That, you know, was pretty close to Medford, but the rest of them were in places like Myrtle Creek, St. Helens, Canyonville. One did close in Roseburg. There were two hospitals in Roseburg, and one closed. But that was more recent. Most of them, I think, were sole providers. In Columbia County particularly, that had a devastating effect on the local economy and on the numbers of physicians. They had 33 physicians in Columbia County in 1990 when that hospital closed. Now they have 11. About two-thirds of the physicians just left the county, mm-hmm. and there still is no hospital care there.
So for care, then people will probably go to the Portland hospitals, Northwest.
They do. Some of them go up through Clatskanie and cross the bridge to Longview. The problem is, of course, that people who have insurance and who have means for transportation are the ones that travel, and the ones who don't have the insurance and who are less, you know, either fragile elderly or low income, are not as able to travel. So it leaves those few physicians who remain with a real disproportionate number of low-income patients who can't afford to pay their bills.
Great. Committee members, any other questions? Well, I think we're going to let you off easy.
Okay, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Seeing no further business of the committee today, we'll adjourn.